Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Matters, the show in which I discuss all matters of the mind and in which I show how much mind matters. Welcome to part 22 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Udo Staatsbuchler and I am live on air and I welcome your calls with questions and comments as long as they relate to the subject I'm talking about. All other questions, comments and suggestions I will answer by email. Just go to my website http://www.mindmattersonline.info. Mind Matters Online is one word. There you'll find my email address and write to me. I will reply within 48 hours. On page 3 of my website and on the following pages, you will find recordings of all my radio programs for you to listen to at your leisure. Last week I spoke about humor, fun and laughter, and in this show I will address something that many of you would think does not lend itself as being a natural sequence to humor, fun and laughter. And I would even agree partly with those of you who think so. But on the other hand, humor, fun and laughter can play a big role in combating cancer and other life-threatening diseases when you use the power of your mind. And that's something, exactly that is what we are talking about today, cancer and how to deal with it. I'm not only spouting theory and wishful thinking here, but I'm talking from personal experience. I was first diagnosed with kidney cancer some 8 years or so ago, and as a consequence, I had one kidney removed. I thought that this was the end of my personal experience with cancer, but I was wrong. A few years later, I was again diagnosed with cancer and have been battling it ever since. And if you thought that I would come up with a definite cure for cancer using mind power or having found the magic formulas, a silver bullet for it, I must disappoint you. At one time I thought I had mastered it, but I was wrong again. However, I succeeded in keeping cancer at bay. It is there, but it hasn't spread, and I hope that it remains dormant. I will know with certainty in a few weeks when I go for another checkup. In addition to my own personal experience with cancer, I've also worked with numerous cancer patients and I have a certificate in psychoneuroimmunology, in short PNI. My work with cancer patients, as well as my own experience, of course, gives me also insights not only how they should behave and what they can do in their fight, but also how the people around them, the families, can contribute to the fight. Lastly, I will also discuss the after treatment, the time after cancer patients had been operated on or had chemotherapies or whatever else was done to remove cancer. Unfortunately, this is a theme that has been badly neglected so far. But it is very important, as most, if not all of you who have been through this dreadful experience, will confirm. What I am not going to discuss are the various medical treatments available for all the various types of cancer, the various diets that are suggested, because firstly, this is way outside my competence, and secondly, there are so many possibilities and also personal preferences that it would be outside the scope of this program. I know that I have mentioned only cancer so far, and I will continue to do so, but what I am going to talk about applies also to most other illnesses and life-threatening diseases. what made me talking about cancer today is the questions that many people, including myself, have been asking themselves for some time now. And the question is, are we losing the war on cancer, or have we come closer to winning it? 100 of the world's leading cancer specialists came together in Lugano in Switzerland 2 weeks ago to formulate an action plan to finish off what President Richard Nixon started on the 23rd of December 1971 when he signed the U.S. National Cancer Act. At that time, most Americans thought that a cancer cure would be discovered within 5 years. Today, more than 40 years later, practically no expert talks about a single cure for the 200 known types of cancer. At that conference in Switzerland, opinions were divided too. Some experts believed we are not going to win the war on cancer, and a few, very few, believed that it is possible. Most of them said that the so-called war on cancer was a wrong metaphor for the struggle against a complex set of diseases that will affect one person in three in their lives. The optimism of the early 1970s has given way to the dogged determination of the cancer community under siege from a still growing global epidemic. The effort on cancer is twofold. One is focused on a cure for patients, and the other is concerned with the elimination of the disease. In the past 40 years, the curability rate has almost doubled, but the elimination is still a utopian dream because the incidence of cancer is increasing and not decreasing, and it is increasing at a speed that is frightening. However, some forms of cancer can be cured today that 40 years ago would have been certain death sentences. Many kinds of cancer are now treatable, and survival rates across almost the entire spectrum have improved dramatically. But cancer is still a leading cause of disease worldwide, accounting for around 13% of all deaths in the year 2008. As the developing world becomes richer, those countries are also being affected by the cancers of the westernized world, which are dominated by the health impacts of smoking and other lifestyle choices. If recent trends continue, according to the WHO, the World Health Organization, the global burden of cancer will increase to 22 million new cases each year by the year 2030, a 75% increase compared with 2008. Let me repeat this number. 22 million new cases each year by 2030. We are winning some battles in the war, but most of the time we are losing them, essentially because cancer is a disease of extraordinary complexity. In 1998, following a front page story in the New York Times about the success of drugs targeting the growth of blood vessels to a tumor, there was widespread hope that a cure for cancer may have finally arrived. The optimism was soon dashed, however, when it was realized that these angiostatins worked only for a while and cost far too much for widespread deployment. The same story of shattered hopes emerged in more recent times with a new generation of targeted drugs designed to work against tumors with a certain genetic makeup. One such drug, BRAF inhibitors, produced near miraculous results in initial trials, with tumors visibly receding within weeks of treatment. However, 6 months later, the tumors returned with a vengeance, with evolution of resistant cancer cells. A possible solution to the problem of cancer resistance is the use of one or more drugs or treatments in combination. This anti-resistance strategy of combination therapy works well against the rapidly evolving AIDS virus. However, many combination drugs are very expensive, hardly affordable when taken alone, let alone when taken together. On top of that, drug companies sometimes appear reluctant to cooperate with competitors holding patents on the other half of the combination therapy. Even when drugs are cheap, as they are when they are off-patent, the pharmaceutical industry sees little financial incentive if clinical trials involve drugs not covered by many years of patent protection. Let me give you a few more numbers. As I said before, estimated cancer increase in cancer cases between 2008 is 75%, and new cases of cancer each year by 2030, 22 million. Proportion of cancer death worldwide caused by smoking is 22%. New cases of cancer worldwide in 2008 was 12.7 million. Proportion of smokers who will die from tobacco-induced cancer, one half. 50% of smokers will die of cancer. Deaths from cancer in 2008 overall was 7.6 million. And new smokers a year in the world, 30 million. Makes you think, doesn't it? So, what can we as individuals do about it? There are a number of substances in our lives that promote cancer over which we have little influence. One of the worst offenders is bisphenol A, in short BPA, an organic compound used in the manufacture of plastic in everyday products. To date, there are 5,708 international studies published in the U.S. National Library of Medicine, including those that link bisphenol A, BPA, to sexual dysfunction, compromised immune systems, diabetes, heart disease, epigenetic health concerns, neurological disruptions, obesity, and then, of course, cancer and much more. The United States, Canada, Japan, and the European Union have now banned BPA for the manufacture of, alas, only baby bottles. However, BPA is found in many products, including polycarbonate plastic products such as reusable water bottles, leftover containers, toys, the lining of canned foods, beverages, pizza boxes, and other fast food containers, non-metal dental fillings, thermal paper, like in receipts, some medical devices even, and BPA even leached into beaches, sand, and water. So as the lobbying and politics continue, people worldwide continue to be at risk. Be aware of it and do your best to avoid BPA, plastic in general. There are many other substances around us that are to be blamed. They are in air pollution in general, in certain additives in food, in chemicals that are used in food production or that we use in our households, and many, many others. Of course, we all know that most of us who have or had cancer have to shoulder also a great deal of culpability. We know that our lifestyle is largely to blame, our Western diet, smoking, and stress being the main causes for cancer. We also know that it would be up to us to change this, and it would be possible. Maybe not easily possible, but still doable. I'm not going to talk about this. What I'm going to talk about is what to do if we have cancer, and also what our environment, our families and friends can do to help us and themselves. There are always voices that say, leave it to the doctors. Doctor knows best. They would prefer to hand over the problem to the doctor and say, it's yours now, deal with it. And then they sit back and wait and hope for the best. And yes, sometimes this is good enough. But imagine how much better it could be if they would also contribute and throw everything they have, all their powers, against the illness. And sometimes this contribution can make the difference between success and failure, which means between life and death. There's also the matter of responsibility. Who is responsible for health and well-being, if not you? Who is most interested in your health and well-being, if not you? What you certainly must not do is to throw in the towel. You must also not feel sorry for yourself or blame yourself as countless I should have done or I should not have done. Not only is it utterly pointless, but it's also counterproductive and makes matters only worse. What you should do is first and foremost boost your self-confidence to the highest possible level. You need this because without it, you cannot establish the belief in yourself that you are capable of mastering all the powers that you have to stand up in your fight against cancer. Because that's what you are going to do. Stand up and fight. In all likelihood, your illness will be the first thought in the morning when you wake up and your last one before you go to sleep. It's inevitable. Therefore, it is extremely important to be in control over the thoughts that you think about cancer. Are you going to cry over the fact that you have cancer? Are you wallowing in self-pity? Are you going to blame yourself and others for it? Are you going to argue with your maker about it? Why or why or why or why it had to be you? Or have you resolved that you keep your illness a secret that nobody should know about? If so, I strongly suggest you change your attitude. Are you talking about your cancer when speaking to others or with yourself in your internal dialogue, thereby accepting ownership of it? It's your cancer, it belongs to you. I strongly suggest you change your use of language. Accept the fact that you have cancer, but resolve that you are going to do everything to get rid of it. But do not leave it at this resolve. Jump into action and do it. Of course you will need your doctor or oncologist to help you. But as I said before, your health is in your own interest, your top priority, and it is also your responsibility. So you better stand up and fight, and don't leave it all to the medical profession. There's science behind what I'm saying, and it is called psychoneuroimmunology, PNI. Psycho refers to your thinking, emotions, and mood states. Neuro refers to the neurological and neuroendocrine systems in your body. Immunology refers to your cellular structures and immune system. PNI explores the influence of your mind on your body and immune system. PNI combines immunology, which is all aspects of the immune system, endocrinology, which is the endocrine glands, hormones, metabolism and respiration, and neuroscience, which is everything that belongs to the nervous system, and also the glands and organs associated with them. And it combines them into a multidirectional network of communication, which is linked by molecules, neuropeptides, carrying information. PNI suggests that the chemicals that are running our body and our brain are the same chemicals that are involved in emotion. And that says to me that we'd better pay more attention to emotions with respect to health. I've also said a few times in previous programs that we cannot separate body and mind. It is one system. The brain is integrated in the body on a molecular level, and therefore neither can we treated separately without the other one being affected. Emotions are real. They exist in time and space and are located throughout our minds and bodies. Our mental state will affect whether we'll get sick or stay healthy from the same loading dose of a virus. This also explains why some people get much sicker than others from an identical exposure to a virus. Therefore, an elevated mood of happiness, positive expectation, or hope does offer quite some protection against the virus. Think about it. What could this possibly suggest about the process of developing cancer and an individual's potential for healing? And further, what is the relationship between the mind, the emotions, and the cancer patient's state of health? Well, as I said, mind is not only in the head. It is also not just a function of the brain, but it is in every single cell of the body. The neuropeptides that I mentioned earlier, the molecules that carry information, are in constant communication with the immune system, which is the mechanism that creates health and disease. If you think now of stress, for example, and it is the unhealthy stress I'm talking about, and not the stress that makes us get up in the morning to do something useful, the stress that is so taxed by mental or physical trauma or unresolved feelings, these molecules pick up on it and carry the information to the endocrine system and to the immune system. And then the physical part of your system will be affected by it. This is why many people develop cancer as a result of a stressful event. It happened to me, I remember exactly. It happened to a good friend of mine, who shortly thereafter died. And it happened to many cancer patients I spoke with. This doesn't mean that a stressful event will create cancer cells and then they multiply in a matter of seconds and then cancer manifests. No, the origins of illness were already within us. The cancer cells were already in the system. Most of us carry cancer cells, errant or mutant cells that used to be healthy cells, and we carry them within us without us being aware of them. But our natural immune system is in control over them until, for example, this stressful event occurs. This event lowers the immune system, and then the cancer cells can develop freely and unhindered. There's some new good news about our immune system. It can learn and respond. The psychologist Robert Ader at the University of Rochester School of Medicine gave laboratory rats an immune-suppressing drug flavored with sweet-tasting saccharin. Eventually, the rats became so conditioned to the effects that giving them only saccharin and no drug at all caused their immune system to become depressed at the unconscious and autonomic level. This demonstrates that the immune system has memory and the capacity to learn. Later in studies at the Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, the scientist Howard Hall proved that the immune system could also be conditioned consciously using self-regulatory practices such as self-hypnosis, biofeedback, guided imagery, relaxation, and autogenic training. Using several control groups, Hall demonstrated that with conscious preparation, through using one of these types of practices, that is, self-hypnosis, biofeedback, guided imagery, and so on, individuals could consciously control the stickiness of their white blood cells as measured by both blood and saliva tests. The question arises, and I would like you to think about it also. If the immune system can be altered by conscious intervention, our conscious intervention, what does it mean for the treatment of major diseases such as cancer? Another question arises. Can suppressing anger or other emotions contribute to the development of cancer? Since expressing emotion contributes to a free-flowing network of peptides and cellular communication in the body, we can say with certainty, yes, absolutely. Research has shown that when emotions are expressed, all systems are united and made whole. When emotions are repressed, denied, not allowed to be whatever they may be, our network pathways get blocked, stopping the flow of the vital feel-good unifying chemicals that run both our biology and our behavior. As I said before, we all have errant or mutated cancer cells created in our bodies every day, yet only some individuals will go on to develop the disease. Normally, our immune system destroys these errant cells. Yet, in individuals whose immune systems are severely compromised, this mechanism fails. If the immune system is influenced by emotions and the peptide system in the body, then what happens if the free flow of peptides is interrupted on a continual basis by the repressed emotions of a lifetime? In a previous program, I discussed emotions and I spoke about positive and negative emotions. Positive emotions are joy, pleasure, peace and such like, whereas negative emotions are anger, fear, guilt and such like. And I said that we should replace negative with positive feelings through reframing, but we should not repress them. To repress feelings creates stress that sets up the weakened condition that can lead to cancer or other diseases. If we cannot replace negative emotions, it is therefore better to express them in a burst of anger or whatever the feeling is, and then let go of it. If you cannot do it on your own, I suggest you seek the help of a competent psychotherapist, because the key is to express it and then let go of it, so that it does not fester or build up again or escalates again. It is very important to aim for emotional wholeness. When you are upset or feeling sick, try to get to the bottom of your feelings. Figure out what is really eating you. Always tell the truth to yourself. Find appropriate, satisfying ways to express your feelings. And if such a prescription seems too challenging, seek professional help to feel better. I believe the psychological therapies are a form of professional help much less likely to do harm and much more likely to do good than any other medicinal approaches. They work by shifting our natural balance of internal chemicals around so we can feel as good as possible. They are often particularly helpful for alleviation of the many chronic maladies that currently have no good medical solutions. Health is so much more than just the absence of illness. Live in an unselfish way that promotes a state of bliss. Live in a state of happiness that truly helps to prevent illness. Wellness is trusting in the ability and desire of your body-mind to heal and improve itself if given half a chance. Take responsibility for your own health and illness. There are a few tools that cancer patients should have a look at in order to improve their chances to get well or to increase the speed of their recovery. I see psychotherapy as an integral and necessary part in the treatment of cancer. As I mentioned before, a competent psychotherapist can assist in the reframing of emotions or expressing them in a constructive and appropriate way. Psychotherapy helps cancer patients to come to terms with the diagnosis and deal with grief, relationships, and lifestyle changes. The therapist will often engage the patient in one-on-one as well as in group therapies that will help to bring an outlet and a voice to underlying issues such as anxiety, depression, and stress that can, if unresolved, exacerbate immunological functioning and the effectiveness of the medical treatment, and therefore can compromise survivability. Nutritional concerns are a priority for cancer survivability. In addition to stressors, inadequate nutrition must be addressed to support being able to withstand surgical procedures and other treatments. Tracking nutrition also helps to determine the cause of treatment ineffectiveness. All experts suggest a combination of disease-specific nutrition as well as dietary education to address complications, weight management, vitamin and mineral deficiencies, and such like. Complementary and relaxation therapies are abundant today. Following years of research on mind-body connection to disease, doctors recognize the need to incorporate spiritual components to the treatment of cancer. There are numerous techniques, for example, relaxation therapies and guided imagery for the management of treatments. Religious or spiritual counselors can help those who believe in religion or in some form of spirituality. In particular, if the counselor's help is giving hope to the individual and strengthen their belief again if they feel disappointed in their faith, let down by a higher power, or out of tune with their beliefs. As seen with complementary and relaxation therapies, some clinical settings understand the importance of hope, optimism, balance, culture, rituals, and practice to the provision of quality cancer care. Unfortunately, there should be many more of those clinical settings. Many, many more. I do know that psychotherapy can help people, including those with cancer, find the inner strength they need to improve their coping skills and allowing them to more fully enjoy their lives. Psychotherapy can be used to help people deal not only with the diagnosis and treatment of cancer, it can also be useful in overcoming depression and anxiety, which are common in people with cancer. Of course, I've used my own method on myself, and I lived my life as before diagnosis, enjoying it, having fun, and most importantly, fighting the disease with confidence, with great confidence. Psychotherapy is available in many forms. People may seek individual therapy, where there is a one-on-one relationship with a therapist. There are also therapists who work with couples or entire families in order to help those most affected by the cancer diagnosis. Psychotherapy also may be practiced with groups in which a number of people meet together to discuss common experiences and issues and to learn specific coping techniques. However, it is important that a group of this kind is chaired by a competent psychotherapist. What does psychotherapy involve? There are many different kinds of psychotherapy, from long-term analysis to brief, problem-oriented treatment. Therapy may include looking at emotional experiences, working with coping styles, doing homework assignments, and much more. Most individual psychotherapy is held in the therapist's office. Some situation may be done in hospital or the patient's home. The number of meetings depends on the problem and the client's response to the therapy. There are a wide range of psychotherapy approaches and techniques. I give you just a few examples. There is behavioral therapy that deals with behavior modification. This therapy focuses on focuses on replacing problematic behavior patterns, such as obsessive-compulsive behavior, with more healthy responses. A behavioral therapist may use techniques such as biofeedback and muscle relaxation. This kind of therapy deals only with the symptoms of a problem. There is client-centered therapy. This form of therapy focuses on the feelings and current experiences of the individual. The therapist encourages the patient to direct the sessions while providing empathy and support. The goal is to help patients help themselves. The length of the therapy varies and depends also on the client's response to the therapy. Then we have body-oriented therapy. This kind of therapy is based on the belief that emotions are stored in the body and may be expressed in the form of physical tension and restriction. Breathing techniques, movement, manual pressure, and probing are used to help people release emotions that have built up in the body. It's a fantastic therapy, and I use it myself too. Cognitive behavioral therapy is probably a very well-known therapy, and it is directed at changing thoughts and behaviors by addressing the repeated faulty negative thoughts that affect behavior. Cognitive behavioral therapists, such as myself, help people to learn to reprogram harmful internal messages and create positive self-talk or internal dialogue. This kind of therapy often includes homework assignments for the patients, such as disputing disturbing thoughts, trying different responses to criticism, or making a list of things he or she likes about himself or herself. It also includes different forms of behavioral therapy. Then we have also what I mentioned before, a family or couples therapy. Family therapy focuses on relationship patterns. All family members may be involved in therapy sessions. A therapist involved in this type of therapy acts as a facilitator to help the family or the couple communicate their feelings more effectively. Although usually the treatment is short-term, it can last longer depending on the needs of the individuals. Then we have group therapy, of course, and I mentioned that one before, and the group therapy varies widely in size as well as in format and in length. Some groups are small and meet weekly without a scheduled agenda. Others may meet monthly and offer information, teach coping skills, help reduce anxiety, and provide a place to share common concerns and emotional support. And I repeat what I said earlier on. If you attend a group therapy, make sure it is a group that is chaired by a competent psychotherapist. Then we have also psychodynamic therapy, and similar to traditional psychoanalysis, the goal of this form of therapy is to change lifelong personality patterns by uncovering the connection between current emotional reactions, early childhood experience. This form of therapy is long-term and focuses on the underlying causes of a problem. It's not necessarily something which I recommend if you are about to go into cancer treatment. Whatever approach is used, when a person has a serious physical illness, such as cancer, the therapy is likely to focus on the emotional stress resulting from the illness. It will also focus on any depression or anxiety or explore past or present issues that may affect the person's adjustment to the illness. What is the evidence for the benefits of psychotherapy? Research has consistently shown that psychotherapy can be beneficial to people with cancer in a variety of ways. A psychologist at the University of California School of Medicine in Los Angeles reported in 1999 that behavioral therapy is most useful in managing anxiety related to specific treatment concerns, such as phobic reactions to needles, fears related to surgery or chemotherapy, or claustrophobic feelings during magnetic resonance imaging, the MRI scans. A 1996 study reported weekly individual cognitive therapy and bi-monthly family counseling improved both depression and quality of life of women with non-metastatic breast cancer. Research has generally shown that psychotherapy can help reduce anxiety and depression in people with cancer, help them make better use of their time, and help them return to work. Psychotherapy can also help people learn to communicate better with their doctors and adhere to medical treatment. In 2006, a study of nearly 200 women with early-stage breast cancer showed that a 10-week cognitive behavioral therapy group course helped the women reduce their social disruptions and improve their outlook and their sense of well-being, and their ability to relax, even up to 1 year after the therapy. A similar effect was shown in a 2006 study of men who had been treated for early-stage prostate cancer with surgery or radiation. The group of men who had the 10-week cognitive behavioral therapy stress management course had better quality of life afterwards than those who did not. Research has not shown, however, that psychotherapy can prolong the life of cancer patients. Only very few controlled studies of this nature have been conducted. In 1982, researchers studied 120 end-stage male cancer patients. About half were randomly assigned to a control group and the other half received individual counseling. Whereas those receiving psychotherapy showed improvement on quality of life measures, no difference was found between groups in survival rate after 1 year. A similar study in 1982 from Stanford University had a similar outcome with women with metastatic breast cancer who received also psychotherapy. But please note that both studies concerned people with end-stage or metastatic cancer. Using positive psychotherapy in cancer that is not end-stage and using it well can assist in prolonging life or even in a cure. I have just realized, that the end of this show is near. And this is a good point to end it. Next week, I will continue with this same theme for a while. Well, perhaps only for a while. If you have any questions about this topic or any comments and suggestions, go to my website, mindmattersonline.info. mindmattersonline is one word. There you will find my email address. Write to me and I will reply as usual within 48 hours. If your question or comment is of interest for most of our audience, now in particular in this particular theme, cancer, I will answer it also in my show next week without mentioning your name, of course, unless you state in your email that you do not want. When you're looking at my website, you will find recordings of all my previous programs from page 3 onwards, so that you can listen to them at your convenience. For now, I thank you for listening and leave you with wise words by Plato. The greatest mistake in the treatment of diseases is that there are physicians for the body and physicians for the soul, although the two cannot be separated. Plato, and he lived more than 2,000 years ago. Tune in again next week. Same day, same time. Goodbye.